Good evening. President Trump wants to send asylum seekers to sanctuary cities in the United States. And a computer bug hits New York City's computers. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Friday, April 12, 2019. President Donald Trump said Friday he's strongly considering releasing illegal immigrants, as he calls them, into Democratic strongholds to punish congressional foes for inaction on the border, just hours after the United States and Homeland Security officials insisted the idea had been rejected as fast as it had been proposed.
We might as well do what they always say they want. We'll bring the illegal, really, you call them the illegals. I call them the illegals. They came across the border illegally. We'll bring them to sanctuary city areas and let that particular area take care of it, whether it's a state or whatever it might be. California certainly is always saying, oh, we want more people, and they want more people in their sanctuary cities. Well, we'll give them more people. We can give them a lot. We can give them an unlimited supply. And let's see if they're so happy. They say we have open arms. They're always saying they have open arms. Let's see if they have open arms. The alternative is to change the laws, and we can do it very, very quickly, very easily. Okay?
Sanctuary cities are places where local authorities do not cooperate with immigration and customs enforcement officials, denying information or resources that would help ICE round up for deportation people living in the country illegally. They include New York City and San Francisco, home city of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who on Friday called the idea unworthy of the presidency of the United States and disrespectful of the challenges that we face as a country, as a people, to address who we are, a nation of immigrants. The Department of Health and Human Services said this week that it had started scouting vacant properties that could be turned into facilities for holding migrant children in several cities, including Atlanta, Dallas, Houston, Phoenix, and San Antonio. Holden Matthews, the white 21-year-old son of a Louisiana sheriff's deputy, was behind bars Thursday, accused of torching three century-old African-American churches during a 10-day period in and around Upalosas. The city of 16,000 people was set on edge by blazes which evoked memories of terrorist acts during the civil rights movement. Authorities said he had no known criminal record. A friend described him as an introverted animal lover who showed no animosity toward any race and a talented, if frustrated, heavy metal guitar player and singer. A fellow musician called him a really sweet guy. Matthews was arrested on three counts of arson of a religious building. A conviction could bring up to 15 years in prison on each count. The fires set many people on edge in and around Upalosas, about 140 miles northwest of New Orleans. Matthews' arrest came a little more than 2 weeks after the first blaze at the St. Mary Baptist Church on March 26 in Port Barre, a town just outside of Upalosas. Days later, the Greater Union Baptist Church and Mount Pleasant Baptist Church were burned. Each was more than 100 years old. The churches were empty at the time, and no one was injured. And WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has exchanged a small room at the Ecuadorian embassy in central London for a cell at Belmarsh Prison, a grim institution in the southeast part of the city, where he nevertheless has certain advantages he didn't have when he was holed up hiding from the law. WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Kristen Raftensen said Friday that the ailing Assange should finally be able to receive medical care and will be able to meet with his lawyers more easily than he could in the embassy, where a feud with Ecuadorian authorities had led to a ban on most guests. The 47-year-old Assange had extreme shoulder pain and tooth pain, according to his supporters. For nearly 7 years, Assange lived in the embassy without taking a step outside for fear of being arrested and sent to the U.S. to be prosecuted. The political debate over whether to extradite Assange is already taking shape, with Britain's opposition Labour Party urging the government not to hand him over to the Americans. Party leader Jeremy Corbyn tweeted that the U.S. is prosecuting Assange because he exposed, quote, evidence of atrocities in Iraq and Afghanistan. Extradition lawyer Ben Keith said the court will not assess the evidence against Assange to determine his guilt or innocence, but will scrutinize whether the offense he is accused of in the U.S. would be a crime in Britain. The most likely outcome is that he will be extradited to the United States, he said. If Assange loses in extradition court, he could appeal several times and ultimately try to have his case heard at the European Court of Human Rights, unless Britain has left the European Union by that time. And a conference to build a new movement to counter the growing nuclear arms race is scheduled for Sunday, April 14th at the New Jersey Institute of Technology in Newark. It would also be live streamed. One of the speakers is Professor Vincent Intonde of Montgomery College. He's author of African Americans Against the Bomb, Nuclear Weapons, Colonialism, and the Black Freedom Movement. Intonde says African Americans and other people of color have been at the center of the movement to ban nuclear weapons from the beginning.
So African-American activists, and certainly nothing's monolithic, but looked at the nuclear arms race and dropping the atomic bombs and nuclear weapons as a whole through the lens of race and colonialism. So if you look at the history, of course, of nuclear testing and who it has overwhelmingly affected, it is people of color from Native Americans and Kazakhstan and Australian Aborigines and French Polynesia and Marshall Islands. And of course, Trump is talking about having nuclear testing start up again. If you look at how Trump has recently said that, you know, Saudi Arabia should have their own nuclear weapons. Japan, South Korea wants to go after Iran, is threatened to use them in North Korea. Again, you see how this overwhelmingly affects people of color. And even in terms of economics, where I'm from in Washington, D.C., not too far in Baltimore, this past winter there wasn't enough money for heat in the Baltimore City schools. Mostly black parents were asked to bring in space heaters for their children. And yet we're spending $1.4 trillion on new nuclear weapons when we have enough to and the world multiple times over. So in terms of where our priorities are, again, you look at how this affects race, and people like Malcolm X and W.E.B. Du Bois and Coretta Scott King and the Black Panthers and Lorraine Hansberry and on all saw these issues and spoke out vehemently against them.
There's just a more sort of naked aggression going on when it comes to nuclear weapons, nakedly talking about them and promoting them as an alternative. What do you see as people's role, people of color, their role?
It's a critically dangerous time right now. I mean, especially if you want to look at how race plays a role in this, there's no bigger example than on one side you have two white nationalist authoritarian leaders in Trump and Putin that possess 90% of the world's nuclear weapons and threatening to use them. And on the other side, you have over 100 nations, majority non-white nations, that have signed on and are working in the UN for a nuclear ban treaty that was passed. So here are so many countries that are fighting this, trying to get a ban on nuclear weapons, and here are these other two that are trying to increase in the amount of nuclear weapons and threaten the world. So I think for people of color, but for all people, is a crucial time that we need to use all of our gifts and all of our abilities to come together and to try to stop this madness because, you know, yes, it is so important that we fight for our undocumented immigrants and so that black lives do indeed matter and so that women have an equal seat at the table and so on. But as Dr. King said, what does it matter if we achieve this social justice if we're all dead from nuclear war? And so it's really, you can't worry about just the country you're trying to fix or in King's case, the country you're trying to integrate and then not be worried about nuclear weapons in the world and what could happen if that happens. So there's absolutely a connection there and we just need to hopefully, you know, people learn from this history of what these black activists did and then are inspired and can take those lessons and do something with it today.
Who are some of the African-American black activists who are involved in the anti-nuclear movement that we should know more about?
Certainly one of the most active was Bayard Rustin, and Rustin we know so little about in general because he was gay, and so he was iced out of a lot of the movement. But Rustin had a huge amount of activism dating back to the 1930s, and actually when the French government decided they wanted to test their first nuclear weapon, they were going to test it in the Sahara in Africa. And so it was Bayard Rustin who actually put a team together with Kwame Nkrumah when Ghana was going through their independence movement, and there was fear of what the nuclear fallout would do to the cocoa industry, and he puts together a team of activists to try to stop the French from doing this. Paul Robeson was a giant in this in fighting right after Truman dropped the bomb. And Robeson, again, is a forgotten figure. And Robeson was asking the question of where is the U.S. getting the uranium to build nuclear weapons? And, of course, the answer was the Belgian-controlled Congo. Langston Hughes was the first to publicly come out and ask if Truman's racism, his own deep-seated racism, had a role in dropping the bomb in Hiroshima. And, again, people like Lorraine Hansberry, who we certainly know for Raisin in the Sun and all of her work, but she was so much more than that. Even the last play that she wrote was about a nuclear holocaust and the two survivors. And so there's just a long history here of African Americans that have fought against this, against the bomb and nuclear issues. That certainly we need to continue that today.
So little is known about the role of the Congo. The Belgian Congo is the source of much of the uranium used, especially in the first two atom bombs and the drama of that story.
Well, I do talk about it in the book that if you look at it through the lens of colonialism, which many black Africans many African American activists did in the United States, then yeah, they were looking at how the from way back when with King Leopold, of course, and then but all the way up through that, you have the uranium industry and what it does in the Congo, not just in taking the uranium and then using it to put into our nuclear weapons to then use on people of color, but what it does to the actual workers and the actual mining industry and the cancer rates and things of this nature that are happening that happened throughout time in the Congo as well. So, you know, whether it was the French testing in Africa, whether it was South Africa building a secret bomb with the help of Israel and then, taking it apart right before Mandela took power, there's absolutely a connection between Africa and nuclear weapons. I mean, Nkrumah, when he came to power, certainly had this on his radar and had multiple conferences and tried to teach this issue as well. So, you know, it's always there in the black community. This conference coming up has got a lot of great voices that we need to hear from Ray Asherson to Zia and more. And we just need more things like this. I think there's just no bigger issue that we need to be focused on right now than this.
Vincent Intonde of Montgomery College. He's author of African Americans Against the Bomb, Nuclear Weapons, Colonialism, and the Black Freedom Movement. Another speaker at Sunday's conference at the New Jersey Institute of Technology in Newark is Pakistani-American physicist and nuclear expert Zia Mian of Princeton. He says we're seeing not just nuclear modernization, but the development of a new nuclear war fighting capability.
The situation today regarding nuclear weapons is much more dangerous than it's been for the last 2.5 decades since the end of the Cold War, because many of the critical arms control treaties that have helped stabilize and begin the process of reducing the danger from nuclear weapons that were built up during the Cold War have been unraveled by the Trump administration. So as a consequence, we see new kinds of nuclear weapons being developed by the United States and other countries, new commitments to use nuclear weapons first in case of a conflict, and we're seeing the breakdown of already existing agreements like the U.S. nuclear deal with Iran, like the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, that mean that the danger of a buildup of a nuclear arms race is much greater than it's been in the past. So we face much greater danger than we've done since the end of the Cold War.
Does the building up of nuclear weapons make it more possible for them to be used?
What we're seeing is not just a building up of nuclear weapons, but a new commitment and a willingness to threaten to use them, which is being made explicitly by a number of countries. Russia, for example, has made it clear that it is committed to using nuclear weapons early in a conflict. The Trump administration has said that it wants new low-yield nuclear weapons, smaller nuclear weapons, so that it can use them even earlier in a conflict. So it's making very clear that it is willing to use nuclear weapons much more aggressively and early in a conflict than, for example, previous American administrations. So the danger is significantly greater than in the past.
Why build something that can never be used?
They assume that at some stage, this idea of nuclear deterrence, that if you have nuclear weapons and I have nuclear weapons, then we won't go to war, that at some stage this threat will not work and it will break down and then you'll actually have to use them. This is why the United States actually has nuclear war plans, as other countries with nuclear weapons have nuclear war plans. So they work on the assumption that I can threaten, but if the threat doesn't work, I have to be prepared and willing and ready to use them. And so we are all the way at the end to the point where in the United States, we are only a matter of minutes away from when the president decides to use nuclear weapons to the first nuclear weapons actually being launched. We are that close to being ready to use nuclear weapons. So it's not this idea of just a threat to use. We are willing and prepared and ready and equipped and trained at moment's notice to use these nuclear weapons.
It defies logic that you would want to destroy the world as a way of preventing defeat in war.
It is. It defies logic completely. And this is why many people who've spent years and years working in nuclear weapons policy, including inside government, including some of the most senior generals who were in charge of U.S. nuclear weapons for many, many years, have said we should have got rid of these nuclear weapons a long time ago. This was a terrible mistake. And that the only reason we've survived so far is because of good luck. And this includes people like Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense for President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He said, we only survived by good luck and the grace of God, not by rational planning or anything like this. It was just luck. And the question is, at some stage, our luck will run out.
Is there something that the citizens can do?
There's a lot of things that the citizens can do, because we're fortunate that the United States is a democracy, and there's a path between what ordinary people want doing and what the government of the United States is actually willing and able to do when it's pushed by its citizens to do the thing that people want it to do. So, for example, there's a lot of effort in Congress right now to make sure that large amounts of money are not spent on this runaway arms race that the Trump administration wants to pursue. So if people don't want a nuclear arms race and billions of dollars being spent on new nuclear weapons that the Trump administration wants to build, that they should make sure that their member of Congress knows what they want, which is to cut the budget for new nuclear weapons. There's also a resolution in the New Jersey State Assembly saying that the people in the state of New Jersey want to have the government of the United States pursue a policy that says we need to end the nuclear arms race. We need to talk to the other nuclear weapon countries about getting rid of all nuclear weapons. And we should support the new United Nations treaty to ban nuclear weapons, which was passed in 2017, and that the United States has not signed. And they should say we should support this treaty, not oppose it. And so people need to let their elected representatives know what they want, because that's the only way that they will respond in the direction that people who are concerned about nuclear weapons want them to, is if they're told that this is what we want you to do. They won't act by themselves on this kind of question, because they get a lot of pushback from other people on the other side saying, no, nuclear weapons are the only thing that, you know, we need to defend ourselves. And so people need to speak up and let their representatives know that these things are happening. And of course, people need to educate themselves about where things are and what's being done in their name when it comes to nuclear weapons.
And there is so little that stone. What is the role? How is the best way for people to find out about this generally archaic subject for most people?
Well, I mean, one of the things they can do is that there is this big conference at the New Jersey Institute of Technology on April the 14th. So people can go to the website of the conference and read some of the issues that are there. If they have time, they could come to the conference. But there are lots of anti-nuclear groups that are working to try and educate the public about these kinds of things. They're easy to find because, you know, all of them have really good websites and good sources of information. There is the Arms Control Association in Washington, D.C., which is a nonpartisan organization that tries to educate Congress and the people about the dangers of nuclear weapons. So there's plenty of sources of information out there. There's a national organization called Peace Action, which works to reduce nuclear weapons budgets and to get rid of nuclear weapons and to reduce all military spending and to reduce the threat of war. And so there's lots of opportunities for people to get involved and to educate themselves and to take part and to speak up.
You've written and are concerned with the development of nuclear weapons between India and Pakistan.
One of the things that, you know, people who believe in nuclear weapons have often argued is that countries with nuclear weapons don't go to war with each other. And in the case of India and Pakistan, we actually have clear evidence that, oh, yes, they do. So both India and Pakistan tested nuclear weapons in 1998, 20 years ago, and 1 year after those nuclear weapon tests, they had a war. And eventually that war ended without, thankfully, with neither of them using their nuclear weapons. And ever since then, there's been one crisis after another. And just in February of this year, there was another crisis where there was a big attack in India, which India traced back to militant groups based in Pakistan, and the Indian Air Force flew across the border into Pakistan and carried out attacks. Pakistan fired back, and it became very close to a rapid escalation into a major conflict. But thankfully, they saw sense and stopped it there. But the government of Pakistan only this week has said they expect more such actions and attacks and crises between India and Pakistan in the future. So it's one of those things where, you know, if nuclear weapons were that good at deterring conflict, these are countries that would be rational and be say, look, the other side has nuclear weapons. We shouldn't be getting into a shooting match with them. But that doesn't stop them.
Anything you'd like to add?
I think that one of the things that people need to think about is that of all the things we worry about, whether it's housing or health or the environment, if we have a nuclear war, nothing else will matter. And as Dr. Martin Luther King famously said, there's no point having civil rights if we're all dead in a nuclear war. We need to reduce and end this fundamental danger which makes all other politics possible.
And Zia Mian is a Pakistani-American physicist and nuclear expert at Princeton. He's one of the speakers at the April 14th conference at the New Jersey Institute of Technology in Newark, which will also be live streamed. And that's some of the news for Friday, April 12th, 2019. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson for the WBAI Evening News. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.